You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
And welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, March 29th, 2024. You're wrapping up your work week with me, Grandpa Dan, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. I've managed the last few weeks to bring back a lighthearted Friday show. The streak ends. I'm not going to be able to do it. Not going to be able to do it today. But the streak I'm not going to end is my streak of reminding you we have our Sven Longshank support link. You like the way I segued that right in there? Just kind of shoehorned that right in there. Do have our Sven Longshank support links here on the Daily Nationalist page. As always, encourage you to take the time, drop an email or drop a postcard, something such as that. Just to let him know we are thinking about him. I don't have any real updates. We don't have any concrete information as far as when he might be released and under what conditions. But we are, of course, continuing to look forward to that day. He is faring well. I stay in regular contact with him via the email system, which works very, very well. And he is doing well. He's holding up just fine. Hopefully, we'll get some more information. And, of course, we're looking forward to hopefully his being released soon. Well, I did show, hopefully you caught my show Monday. We're fresh out of the terrorist attack in Russia. And I'm kind of going to extend off of that, but onto some other topics, because we're barreling towards this escalation. We're barreling towards things getting worse on several fronts. And just recently, the head of the Russian, I believe it's FSB, came out and he basically said that the U.S., he flat out said the U.S., the U.K. and Ukraine were more than likely behind this terrorist attack. Now, as I said on the Monday show, the U.S. likes to play these word games, you know. Oh, you can't say it was us. Look, it's ISIS-K. It's ISIS-K. It's not just regular ISIS. It's ISIS-K. We just totally know. We didn't know anything about this, but we totally, within an hour of the terrorist attack, they totally knew it was ISIS-K. As I said on the Monday show, literally everybody with a pulse that pays any attention knows that ISIS is just a branch of the CIA / the Mossad. So to sit here and say with a straight face, oh, it was ISIS, it totally wasn't us, is just a slap in the face. And as I said, as much as the U.S. likes to play this word game, like the world is a courtroom and they've got the judge bought off, and as long as they control the narrative, they can sit here and play these word games. You cannot prove technically it wasn't us. This whole Ukraine nonsense from the get-go has been this game like this. Oh, well, we're not actively in the war. We're just giving all of the weapons and, oh, we're sending people and technically calling them mercenaries and unlimited money so you can kill as many Russians as you can. But we're not active combatants. You can see, we're right over here. It's akin to a little kid sitting there in the back seat, poking their, you know, putting their finger in the face of their sibling, going, I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you. But that game goes as long as the other party plays along with it. And as I said on the Monday show, if the other party says, no, we don't care what word games you play, it was you. It doesn't matter. There is no world court. This isn't a courtroom, and your legal word games, your word spells you're casting, don't really amount to anything. That only works as long as everybody plays along, but the other people have a choice in the matter. The other people could say, well, yeah, it is you. No, no, it's not. And if the other person says, no, it is you, and punches you in the mouth, it really doesn't matter your little word spells, your little word games you're trying to play. And to have the head of the FSB come out and say this, it implies that Russia's moving closer to not playing the game any longer. They've played the game to an extent up to this point, but there's an implication here that they're not going to keep playing the game at least a whole lot longer. From what I understand on Russian television right now, you know, in their news over there, there's basically a public outcry to just go ahead and start leveling parts of Kiev, which it is pretty ridiculous that they're able to sit there. I always find it ridiculous. On the one hand, we're told, oh, Ukraine is struggling for its life. They're in a war for the sake of the democracy. It's a war. Why, look, their brave leader has to wear a green t-shirt around. It's all so scripted. And yet you have all these government officials, politicians, and different leaders. They fly in and out of Kiev. And they actually, you might wonder, well, how do they do that without being worried about being shot down, their plane being shot down or blown up or something? And the way that works is they contact Russia ahead of time and say, hey, you know, Macron is coming in to do a press conference and take a photo shoot with Zelensky. Please don't bomb us. And the Russians are kind enough to oblige. But we're starting to see some cracks in that. We're starting to see some indications that that kindness is starting to play out. When you look at back at history and different events that have unfolded, once they're over, you know, once big events happen, wars and things such as that, when you really dig in and look at what leads up to it, you see that along the way, there's always multiple off-ramps. At any point in time, the people involved could have chosen to take an off-ramp, and you could have saved countless lives, countless amounts of destruction, unnecessary suffering, and unnecessary bloodshed. But yet, they just seem to propel, they just continue on their own momentum down the highway towards destruction. I look at the events today on multiple fronts, and we're going to get into that, not just this Ukraine business, but on multiple fronts. And I see the same thing. Things are just continuing to be propelled in a large part by their own momentum, just for no other reason than, but we have to do that. I mean, if you think about World War I, in hindsight, it was stupid to get that kicked off basically because, well, we had this treaty with these people. We had everybody who had previously made these treaties with countries that at the time they made the treaty were more relevant than they were at the outbreak of the war. But, well, we signed the treaty, so we got to stick with it. It bound by a treaty to destruction. This is one of the problems with all these mutual defense treaties. Is you tie yourself into somebody, and then down the road, there's no expiration. Nobody signs a treaty and says, well, this treaty's good for 10 years, but on this date, we tear it up. They go on indefinitely. You sign a treaty with a country that's relevant at that time, but 10, 15, 20 years from there, they're no longer relevant. The U.S., that is to say NATO, it's one and the same. The U.S., has spent years running around bringing these different countries into NATO, countries that are relevant. You know, the Baltic countries, these make-believe countries I always make fun of, Estonia, Lithuania, these aren't even real countries. They just exist because nobody bothers them. They're not big enough to be worth kicking over. But they bring them into NATO under the insinuation that now the United States will fight World War III to defend Estonia. And this leads for their women leaders in these make-believe countries to come out and make bold grand statements about, we're not afraid. Nobody should be afraid to fight Russia. We. For one thing, this bitch isn't going to go fight anybody, personally. If a war broke out, I should be on the first plane heading out of the country sending frantic messages to the Russians, please don't shoot me down. And second of all, her make-believe country. I talked about that recently, and it's like, I said Estonia. Turns out Estonia, because their woman leader had come out, their woman political leader had come out and made some grand statements about not being afraid to fight the Russians. And then you get into the story and it's like their entire military, not just the fighting people, the entire military is like just over 4,000 people. I mean, that's a joke. I could gather enough deer hunters up here in Texas in deer season to take out an army of 4,000 people. That's laughable. But you see, it's all led on by these treaties. And these treaties lead to barreling on down the highway. Nobody's saying, hey, we may not want to be going here. Let's look for an off-ramp. The U.S. undertook this Ukraine project with the idea that they were going to somehow lead to a color revolution and overturn Putin and destroy Russia's economy. And none of that happened. And instead of going, when that became obvious, that wasn't going to happen. And instead of saying, well, this isn't working, let's go ahead and exit off of this road. They just keep going, you know, just keep going. I mean, the Ukraine is down to just doing terrorist attacks. It's not accomplishing anything. I mean, if you're a small group opposing a big power and you want political change, the reason you undertake terrorism is to exert pressure. This is a textbook definition, by the way, of what terrorism is. A lot of people have lost sight of that because the government just defines now, they just find anything they don't like as terrorism. They sit there and the U.S. government will go in and invade a country. And then when the people in that country fight back, they say, oh my gosh, look, the terrorists are attacking us. Well, they're not terrorists, they're defending their country. Actual textbook definition, terrorism, if you have a small, less powerful little group and you're trying to take on a more powerful political entity, a government, you terrorize the citizens, and the idea is the citizens will then turn around and demand their government stop doing whatever it is they're doing that your small group wants them to stop doing, and you exert pressure on them to do that. These Ukrainian terrorist attacks, whether they're artillery shelling these people who they claim they want, on the one hand, they say, oh, we're trying to, quote unquote, liberate these areas. Imagine that. They're trying to say they're wanting to liberate these areas. They're wanting to bring them back. We're trying to liberate them and bring them back to the home of the Ukraine while they attempt to slaughter the people that live there. They are launching these attacks. Well, it's obvious at this point that they're not going to make the people in Russia, you know, exert pressure on the Kremlin to change policy and give Ukraine everything they want. As I said earlier, now the opinion in the public and the opinion on TV and the media in Russia is one of, okay, we've been nice long enough. It's time to kick these people's face in. You know, it's time to just level them. We've been nice. We've given them a chance. And they've ignored the off-ramps. This is continuing just by its own momentum. They're doing these terrorist attacks. We all know that the U.S., the U.K., there's a kind of a picture. I've been reading a lot of people that do good analysis. And there's this picture that this is all tied in with Victoria Nuland there. But her resigning. There is a theory, and I think it's a very plausible one. She was the one that put that whole terrorist attack at the theater plan. You know, basically it was her baby. It was supposed to happen earlier. Well, the security was too tight, but then the plan was already in motion. So they just did this where there was no actual point to it, but they just do it anyway. Again, no off ramps. And they just keep going on. I mean, what was this supposed to accomplish? If your goal was to, you know, rally the people of Russia to make them want to push your shit in. I mean, congratulations, I guess. Mission accomplished. As if the U.S. playing, you know, casting their word spells frantically, going, no, it's ISIS-K. You can't prove we had anything to do with it. As if that's going to matter. I always talk about, because it's so laughable, it's one of those things, you know, you hear this stuff, And, you know, there's just certain things that are so ridiculous, they stick with you. And I always reference the U.S. government official sometime back several years ago, I guess now at this point, a year or so ago. And they said, it doesn't matter what Russia does on the battlefield, if they win or lose, what matters is that we control the narrative. And it just, that has stuck with me because that's the world these people live in. They think as long as they're making Russia lose in the media, look bad on Twitter, that's all that matters is the narrative that we control. It doesn't matter if they blow us all up. Nobody's taking the off-ramp. Nobody's even considering the off-ramp. We just have to keep doing what we're doing. The U.S. now is kind of, you see this move, they're kind of trying to shove the Ukraine project off on the Europeans because now they've got this whole thing with Israel going, which, my gosh, we can't ignore that. While also, for some reason, wanting to stir up tensions with China over Taiwan. Things just go on. I always laugh about how ridiculous it is that the U.S. gets defeated militarily time after time. The U.S. is fresh off being defeated by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And they turn around then and they pivot to Russia like, well, yes, we lost to a small insurgency of people in Afghanistan, but if we take on a real army, it'll be different this time. Well, we're losing in Ukraine, but don't worry, if we pivot to China, it'll be different this time. The military industrial complex, they're raking in contract money on all of this stuff. They've had a model for years. It doesn't matter if they win or lose. The idea is just keep selling weapons and getting richer. And of course, the politicians and the generals and all the rest of the high ranking people, they all get a cut out of all of this and everything goes along just fine. One thing's the Ukraine thing and sending these weapons, these NATO weapons, these U.S. weapons over there is really demonstrated is that these weapons, they're just really expensive. I laugh still. You hear normie Americans talk about, yeah, well, I'll tell you what, they better watch out because you know what? They won't last against the U.S. military. Just look. Look how much, how big, how much bigger our military. No, your military is just more expensive. People conflate the U.S. military being very expensive with it being large and powerful. Sure, anybody can sit here and point to the absurdities of all the troops have to go through sensitivity and diversity training and the picture of the troops walking around in heels and that sort of silly thing. But the bigger issue with the U.S. military is the fact that it's not big, nor is it powerful. I mean, it is powerful. I'm not trying to say it's not powerful at all, but it's way overhyped. Because like if you look at the numbers, people say, well, the U.S. military is, you know, 10 times more powerful than all the rest of these other countries combined. No, it's more expensive. All that is based on how much is spent. And what the Ukraine thing has really highlighted is these weapon systems are not superior. They're just more expensive. It's just like if you went out and bought a really expensive car. You know, and it wound up, it's just really expensive. It's actually less reliable than a cheaper car. Like if you look at motorcycles as an example, if you look at sport bikes, if you want to spend a lot of money, you can go out and get you an Italian-made Ducati. And that you swing. I got a Ducati. I spent $35,000, $40,000 and I have a Ducati. And look, it's fast. It's flashy. It says Ducati right here. You sniff it. It smells like Italy. But it's like multiple times less dependable than a Honda or a Kawasaki. That's a fraction of the price. It's just more expensive. That's how the U.S. military is a Ducati. It's the Ducati of military. It's just really expensive. Not to say it doesn't work at all. But it's just really, really expensive and it's actually much less reliable, all of this equipment. When you have to talk about boondoggles like the F-35, it's a boondoggle. It's just meant to drain money. The problem is now the economy, and you've had generations of Americans who have been taught that the U.S. came out of the Great Depression because of World War II. And they equate that with war is good. You have mainstream economists that say, well, if you spend a lot of money like the U.S. did in World War II, it stimulates the economy. This is the whole basis of a lot of Western economic thought. They look at World War II. They were sold, they believe this narrative that, well, World War II is what brought the U.S. out of the Great Depression because the government spent all this money on war. That stimulated the economy. So they say that you've seen all these different economic attempts, these attempts to revitalize the U.S. failing economy over the years. And they said, well, we don't even have to do a war. We just need to spend a lot of money like it's a war. We'll spend a lot of money. It'll revitalize the economy. The problem is they don't even understand any of this history. Did World War II bring the U.S. out of the Great Depression? Well, in a sense, yes, it did, because every other economic, you know, every other manufacturing economy in the world had been blown to smithereens. Japan had been leveled. Germany and Europe, much of Europe, had been leveled. Britain had been leveled. Basically, the only manufacturing powerhouse left in the world was the U.S., and they had no competition. That's why you had this boom time in the 50s, because everybody else had been wiped out. But you start seeing that economic power, that economic boom, start fading away as soon as the 1960s, and for sure within the 1970s. Why? Because those countries had begun to rebuild, and now the U.S. had competition again, and things started evening out. But people think that you have these economists and these educated people, and they think that the act of war, the war itself, literally saved the economy. And you have these people, a lot of these people, making these decisions today. The U.S. is failing economically. We just need a big war. But with who? China? Russia? I mean, they can't seem to make up their mind. And, of course, now Israel has got this whole storm in the Middle East. And the U.S. is subservient to Israel. So, I mean, they can't ignore that. Keep barreling down the highway. This stirring up war with China, you know, on the China aspect is like one of the most ridiculous things. I mean, their original idea with Russia and the Ukraine, that they were going to put these sanctions on, they needed an excuse, slap these sanctions on, and this was collapse the Russian economy, and then they could foment a color revolution, get Putin out, put a Western puppet in there, and go in and basically raid the Russian economy for whatever they could, loot, get the loot. It's no different than when armies in days gone by would go in and loot the enemy, and that's how they made their money. They go in, just take their stuff. It's kind of the same thought. I mean, that didn't work, but at least you can look at it and say, well, I can see where they were going with it. You know, I can see what the idea was. When it comes to the China thing, this is the most absurd idea. It doesn't make any sense to me on any level. China is a manufacturing powerhouse. China is today, and I'm not being a China show, I'm just looking at things for what they are. China is today the equivalent of what the U.S. was as far as manufacturing ability in, say, 1948 or 1950. I mean, yeah, they're not the only ones. They're quickly becoming that now that the Europeans have voluntarily self-immolated for the U.S. on behalf of the U.S. over this Ukraine thing. I mean, the U.S. basically has financially carpet bombed Germany when they cut off their cheap Russian gas. But China is a manufacturing powerhouse. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy is a financialized economy. They can build ships. China can build ships. They can build weapons, munitions. And the U.S. can build financial instruments, charge interest, maybe make a commission do some financial wizardry. And you see, we create this new derivative. And if you charge an interest rate on the derivative that doesn't actually exist, somehow you're making money and you're going to fight an economic powerhouse, a manufacturing powerhouse. Everything isn't about money. If you actually start a war with somebody and you're incapable of making things, but except for financial wizardry, and the other side is capable of building a shit ton of bombs and missiles, I don't have to sit here and write an essay on who's going to win that. At the end of the day, whoever's able to make the more stuff, whoever's got more people, whoever has a more cohesive society, is going to win out over a country that's divided, has no social cohesion, no common vision amongst the people, and whose economic output is centered around some form of usury. I mean, it's just, no, I can't even figure out any sort of actual reasoning. So you have to assume that these people, again, they just live in this bubble. They live in the bubble. Well, we say, it's as long as we can control the narrative and nobody takes the off-ramp. They just keep going. Well, this was part of the plan. We're just going to keep going. Speaking of the U.S. and their financialized U.S. economy, I read a story just this morning. You know, lo and behold, the 1% gained some more wealth, like $5 trillion more wealth, while everybody else continues to get poorer. And they act like this is sustainable. This in and of itself, anybody with any sense, like if suddenly you woke up today, snapped your finger, got rid of the democracy system and put somebody competent, an authoritarian, an autocrat, whatever term you want to use, you put somebody who's able to actually make decisions and make things happen and you put them in charge, the first thing they would look at is this and say, this is not sustainable. This is going to rip the country apart. You can't have this tiny percentage of people who are accumulating massive amounts of wealth and everybody else is getting poorer. At some point in time, it all falls apart. I've said for years, I said the only thing holding the U.S. together as far as the people goes is the perception, whether it's real or not, the perception of relative economic prosperity. I'll see Americans on the internet, and they'll say stupid things like, China's just a third world shithole. It's like, do you not even have internet access? I mean, you obviously have internet access. You can go and look and see what their cities look like. What are you talking about? They're backward, like they're all walking around in rice fields and mud huts or something compared to the prosperous United States. You see, when people just are living in an illusion, they keep going down this road telling themselves everything is fine. And historically, afterwards, people look back and say, wow, they had all these opportunities to make a choice to stop that path, to see. I mean, anyone could see how this guy sitting down in Texas is not exactly a rocket scientist. He's just a regular guy. He could look around and go, wow, this is going somewhere really bad. Why didn't the people in charge? Why didn't nobody say, hey, we need to stop and take an off-ramp here and maybe do something different? You know, do something different. We need a different plan. And instead, they ignore the off-ramps. They just keep going. Just because we can't look weak. You hear all these ridiculous excuses, you know. Oh, America's credibility on the world stage. Whenever people resort to these ridiculous slogans and these things that have no tangible, actual meaning, you know? America's credibility on the world stage. What the hell does that even mean? We have to keep going down what everyone can see is a bad and incorrect path for some notion of America's credibility, whatever the hell that is, on the world stage, as if it's all a theater. Maybe they're telling us more with these things. If you read a little closer between the lines, it's all a stage. It's all scripted. We have to keep going because we're on a stage and we got to have everybody thinking how credible the U.S. is. And nobody's taking the off-ramp. we're headed towards things being really, really bad, and nobody's taking the off-ramp. Domestically, economically, as I said before, anybody with any sense can look at this, the current economic trend in the U.S. and say this is not sustainable. At some point, it's all going to blow up. If the only thing that is as bad as social tensions are in the U.S., if the only thing holding whatever there is together is the perception of relative economic prosperity, and you're stripping that away when a tiny percentage of the population is accumulating all of this wealth and everybody else can just, you know, eat bugs. You know, it's not sustainable. But they keep doing it anyway. I saw a ridiculous, talk about non-sustainable and ridiculous things. I saw the head of BlackRock, Larry Fink, and he said that, you know, it's ridiculous, this idea that Americans can retire at 65 is outdated. People are living longer. That's a lie, by the way. The lifespan in the U.S. is actually declining, but, you know, Larry Fink, lie, who could imagine it? He says it's ridiculous that she'd be retired at 65. They need to sacrifice and keep slaving longer. The answer to the government going broke isn't not send unlimited money and weapons to Israel or the Ukraine. No, the answer is you just need to keep working into your old age. That's the answer. While this guy sits here and rakes in just ridiculous amounts of money. The guy makes more in a month than most people make in a year. The guy makes more in a year than most people will make in their lifetimes. And instead of having the self-awareness to sit down and shut the hell up, he goes and does prominent interviews talking about how the people just need to keep working longer. You just quit being lazy. I got to go get on my yacht. And these are the types of people that are calling the shots. He's a shot caller. When these are the type of people calling the shots, this is why we're not on the off-ramp. Y'all get out there and work harder. While I cash my latest $20 million check or whatever the hell. While I go and have some politician, you know, kiss my ass, you know, because I own them. You think when Larry Fink calls some congressman or senator, you think they pick up the phone? Damn right they do. These people all assume that they'll be fine. To hell with the rest of us. And so they keep barreling down this road. And then you look down the road and it's like, this isn't going to end well, but they think they'll be able to jettison out. They'll go to some island where they have a bunker or something, and they'll sit on their yacht, sip martinis while the world burns. I think that's foolish on their part. They believe their money will protect them, but as the money collapses, so will their protection. You know, I always say these powerful people, they're powerful because, you know, men with guns will do what they're told and force other people to go along with it. But if they can't pay the men with guns, then it all comes falling apart. Anyway, we're going to wrap up on that note. I hope you have a good weekend. I hope you've had a chance to check out our content here on Radio Albion. And if not, hey, take some time over the weekend. Go back. It's one of the nice things about the podcasting format. You can go back and check it out anytime you want to. I'll be back here on Monday of next week. That's the big plan, assuming nothing awful happens. Something doesn't come up. I'll be back here Monday to kick off your work week. Again, I hope you enjoy your weekend. Keep the faith, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.